Cynical, patron, but I'll try. And you? Frère Simon must be finished copying the chant we found on the prior. I'll go and get it. I also have a few quiet questions for him. But first I want to finish reading the coroner's and the forensics reports in peace. A sharp, determined footfall echoed in the chapel. Both men turned toward it, though each knew what they'd see. Not one of the soft-footed monks, that was certain. Chief Superintendent Francois was walking toward them, his feet clacking on the stone floor. "Gentlemen," said Francois, "did you enjoy your lunch?" He turned to Gamache. "I could hear you and the other monk discussing poultry, was it?"
"Chickens," confirmed Gamache. "Chanticleer, to be exact."
Beauvoir repressed a smile. Francois hadn't meant for Gamache to be quite so enthusiastic. "Asshole," thought Beauvoir. And then he caught sight of Francois's cold eyes staring at the chief, and his smile froze on his face. "I hope you have something more useful planned for this afternoon," said the superintendent, his voice casual.
"We do. Inspector Beauvoir is planning to tour the basement with Frère Aymon, looking for a possible hidden room. And maybe even the murder weapon," Gamache added. "And I'm off to speak further with the abbot's secretary, Frère Simon, the man I was talking to over lunch."
"About pigs, perhaps, or goats?" Beauvoir grew very still, and watched the two men in the peaceful, cool chapel glare at each other, for a beat. And then Gamache smiled.
"If he'd like. But mostly about that chant I told you about."
"The one found on Frère Mathieu?" asked Francois. "Why talk to the abbot's secretary about that?"
"He's making a copy of it, by hand. I'm just going to get it."
Beauvoir noticed that Gamache was underplaying what he wanted to speak to Frère Simon about.
"You gave him the one piece of solid evidence we have?"
That Francois was incredulous was obvious. What wasn't obvious to Beauvoir was how Gamache managed to not snap back.
"I had no choice. I needed the monk's help in figuring out what it is. Since they don't have a photocopier, this seemed the only solution. If you have another, I'll be happy to hear it, sir."
Francois barely pretended at civility anymore. Beauvoir could hear his breathing from feet away. He suspected the monks, silently moving along the edges of the blessed chapel, could also hear the deep and ragged breaths, like bellows, fanning Francois's rage.
"Then I'll come with you," said the superintendent, "to see this famous piece of paper."
"With pleasure," said Gamache, and pointed the way.
"Actually," said Beauvoir, thinking quickly, "it felt a bit like leaping off a cliff. I was wondering if the superintendent would like to come with me." Both men now stared at Beauvoir, and he could feel himself in free fall.
"Why?" they asked together.
"Well, he couldn't possibly give them the real reason, that he'd seen the murderous look in Francois's eyes, and he'd seen the chief slip his right hand into his left and hold it softly there."
"Well," Beauvoir repeated, "I thought the superintendent might like a tour of the abbey, the places most people never see, and I could use his help."
Beauvoir saw Gamache's brows rise ever so slightly, then lower. And Beauvoir looked away, unable to meet his chief's eyes. Gamache was annoyed at Beauvoir. It happened from time to time, of course, in the high-stress, high-stakes job they had. They'd sometimes clash. But never had he seen that look on Gamache's face. It was annoyance, but it was more than that. The chief knew perfectly well what Beauvoir was doing, and Gamache's feelings about it went way beyond mere disapproval, beyond anger even. Beauvoir knew the man enough to see that. There was something else in the chief's face, visible for just that instant when he'd raised his brows. It was fear.
Chapter 22. Jean-Guy Beauvoir grabbed the rolled-up plans of the monastery off the desk in the prior's office. As he did, he glanced at Gamache, who sat in the visitor's chair. On his lap were the coroner's and forensic reports. Francois was waiting for Beauvoir in the Blessed Chapel, and he had to hurry back. But still, he paused. Gamache put his half-moon reading glasses on, then looked at Beauvoir.
"I'm sorry if I overstepped, Chief,"
said Beauvoir.
I just...
Yes. I know what you just...
Gamache's voice was unyielding. Little warmth left in it.
He's no fool, you know, Jean-Guy. Don't treat him like that. And never treat me like that.
Désolé, said Beauvoir, and meant it. When he'd offered to take the superintendent off Gamache's hands, he never dreamed this would be the chief's reaction. He thought the chief would be relieved.
This isn't a game, said Gamache.
I know it isn't, patron. Chief Inspector Gamache continued to stare at Beauvoir.
Do not engage with Superintendent Francois. If he taunts, don't respond. If he pushes you, don't push back. Just smile and keep your eye on the goal. To solve the murder. That's all. He's come here with some agenda. We both know that. We don't know what it is, and I for one don't care. All that matters is solving the crime and getting home. Right?
Oui, said Beauvoir.
D'accord.
He nodded to Gamache and left. If Francais had an agenda, so did Beauvoir. And it was simple. To just keep the superintendent away from the chief. Whatever Francais had in mind, it had something to do with Gamache. And Beauvoir was not going to let that happen.
For God's sake, be careful.
The chief's final words followed Beauvoir down the corridor and into the Blessed Chapel. As did his last view of Gamache, sitting in the chair, the dossier on his lap, a paper in his hand. And the slight tremor of the page as a draft caught it. Except that the air was completely still. At first Beauvoir couldn't see the superintendent. Then he found him by the wall, reading the plaque.
So this is the hidden door into the chapter house,
said Francois, not looking up as Beauvoir approached.
The life of Gilbert of Sempringham isn't interesting reading, I'm afraid. Do you think that's why they hid the room behind here? Knowing any possible invader would die of boredom on this very spot?
Now Chief Superintendent Francois did look up, right into Beauvoir's eyes. There was humour there, Beauvoir saw, and confidence.
I'm all yours, Inspector. Where to?
Beauvoir regarded the Chief Superintendent and wondered why the man was so friendly to him. Francois knew without a doubt that Beauvoir was loyal to Gamache, was one of the Chief's men. And while Francois baited and goaded and insulted the chief, he was only extremely pleasant, charming even, to Beauvoir. Beauvoir grew even more guarded. A frontal attack was one thing, but this slimy attempt at camaraderie was something else. Still, the longer he could keep this man away from the chief, the better. The stairs are over here. The two Sûreté men walked to the corner of the chapel, where Beauvoir opened a door. Worn stone steps led down. They were well lit, and the men descended until finally they were in the basement. Beauvoir stood, not on dirt as he had expected, but on huge slabs of slate. The ceilings were high and vaulted.
"The Gilbertine don't seem to do anything half-assed," said Francois.
Beauvoir didn't answer, but it was exactly what he'd been thinking. It was cooler down there, though not cold, and he suspected the temperature would stay much the same, even as the seasons above changed. Large wrought-iron candle holders were bolted to the stone, but the light came from naked bulbs strung along the walls and ceiling.
"Where to?" Francois asked.
Beauvoir looked this way, then that. Not at all sure. His plan, he realized, hadn't been thought all the way through. He'd expected to arrive in the basement and, for some reason, find Frère Raymond right there. Now he felt a fool. If he'd been with Chief Inspector Gamache, he'd have made a joke, and they'd have gone looking for Frère Raymond together. But he wasn't with Gamache. He was with the Chief Superintendent of the Sûreté du Québec. And Francois was staring at Beauvoir. He wasn't angry. Instead, he looked patient, as though working with a rookie agent who was just doing his bumbling best. Beauvoir could have slapped that look right off his face. Instead, he smiled. Deep breath in, deep breath out. He was the one who'd invited the superintendent along, after all. He had to at least appear happy to have him. To cover his uncertainty, Beauvoir walked over to one of the stone walls and put his hand on it. "Frère Raymond told me over lunch that the foundations are cracking," said Beauvoir, examining the stone as though this was the plan all along. He mentally kicked himself for not making arrangements with the monk.
"Vraiment?"
asked Francois, though he seemed less than interested.
What does that mean?
It means Saint-Gilbert is collapsing. He says it'll fall down completely within 10 years.
Now he had Francois's attention. The superintendent walked over to the wall across from Beauvoir and examined it.
Looks fine to me, he said.
It looked fine to Beauvoir, too. No gaping cracks, no roots breaking through. Both men peered around. It was magnificent. Another engineering marvel by Dom Clément. The stone walls ran under the entire monastery. It reminded Beauvoir of the Montreal metro system, only without the humming subway trains. 4 cavernous corridors, like tunnels, stretched away from them. All well-lit, all swept clean, nothing out of place. No murder weapon lying around, and no pine forest growing out of the walls. But if Frère Raymond was to be believed, Saint-Gilbert entre les loups was falling in on itself. And while Beauvoir had no great fondness for monks or priests or churches or abbeys, he discovered he'd be sorry if this one disappeared. And he'd be very sorry if it disappeared while they were standing in the basement. The sound of a door closing echoed toward them, and Francois started walking in that direction, not waiting to see if Beauvoir followed. As though it didn't matter to him, so insignificant and incompetent was Inspector Beauvoir.
Shithead, mumbled Beauvoir.
A sound travels down here, you know, said Francois, without turning around. Despite Gamache's warnings, despite his own pledges, Beauvoir had already allowed himself to be goaded, allowed his feelings to flare. But maybe it was a good thing, thought Beauvoir, as he slowly followed Francois. And maybe Gamache was wrong, and Francois needed to know that Beauvoir wasn't afraid of him. Francois needed to know he was dealing with a grown man, not some kid out of the academy, in awe of the title of chief superintendent. Some kid he could manipulate. Yes, thought Beauvoir, as he walked a few steps behind the striding superintendent. That wasn't a mistake at all. They arrived at a closed door. Beauvoir knocked. There was a long pause. Francois reached for the handle just as the door opened. Frère Raymond stood there. He looked alarmed, but on seeing them, his expression changed to one of exasperation.
Are you trying to scare me to death? You could have been a murderer.
They rarely knock, said Beauvoir. He turned and had the satisfaction of seeing the superintendent looking at Frère Raymond completely bewildered. Francois appeared not just surprised, but stunned by this rough-hewn subterranean monk who spoke with the ancient dialect. It was as though the door had opened and a monk from the first congregation, from Dom Clément's community, had stepped out.
Where are you from, mon frère?
Francois finally asked. And now it was Beauvoir's turn to be surprised, as was Frère Raymond. Chief Superintendent Francois had asked a question in the same broad accent as the monk's. Beauvoir examined the superintendent to see if he was making fun of the monk, but he wasn't. In fact, his expression was one of delight.
Saint-Félix de Beauce, said Frère Raymond. You? Saint-Gédéon de Beauce, said Francois, just down the road.
What followed was a rapid exchange between the men that was almost unintelligible to Beauvoir. Finally, Frère Raymond turned to Beauvoir.
This man's grandfather and my great-uncle rebuilt a church in Saint-Ephrem after the fire.
Frère Raymond motioned the men into the room. It, too, was huge, wide and long, running the balance of the corridor. The monk gave them a tour, explaining the geothermal system, the ventilation system, the hot water system, the filtration system, the septic system, all the systems. Beauvoir tried to remain focused in case anything useful was said, but eventually his mind grew numb. At the end of the tour, Frère Raymond walked to a cabinet and brought from it a bottle and 3 glasses.
This calls for a celebration, he said. It's not often I meet a neighbor. A friend of mine is a Benedictine and sends me this.
Frère Raymond handed Beauvoir the dusty bottle.
Like a slug.
Beauvoir examined the bottle. It was B&B, brandy and Benedictine. Not made, fortunately, from fermented monks, though he suspected there were enough of those, but by the Benedictines themselves, from a long secret recipe. The 3 men pulled chairs around a drafting table and sat. Frère Raymond poured.
Santé,
he said, tipping the deep amber liquid toward his rare guests.
Santé,
Beauvoir said, and brought it to his lips. He could smell it, rich and full, sweet but also medicinal. His eyes burned from the strength of it. The B&B seared his throat as he swallowed, then the alcohol exploded into his gut and brought tears to his eyes. And it was good.
So, mon frère, Superintendent François cleared his throat, then began again. His accent was back to where Beauvoir recognized it, as though the B&B had burned the ancient dialect away.
Inspector Beauvoir here has some questions. Beauvoir shot him an annoyed look. It was a small dig, as though he needed François to pave the way. But Beauvoir simply smiled and thanked the superintendent. Then he unfurled the scroll and watched Frère Raymond for a reaction. But there was none, beyond the polite nodding as the monk stood and bent over the old plan of the monastery.
"Have you seen this before?" asked Beauvoir.
"Many times."
He looked into Beauvoir's face.
"I consider this an old friend."
His lean hand hovered over the vellum.
"I practically memorized it when we were looking to put in the geothermal."
He turned back to the plan, an affectionate look on his face.
"It's beautiful."
"But is it accurate?"
Well, not these bits."
The monk pointed to the gardens.
"But the rest is surprisingly precise."
Frère Raymond sat back down and launched into an explanation of how the first monks, back in the mid-1600s, would have built the monastery. How they did measurements, how they transported rocks, how they dug.
"It would have taken them years and years," said Raymond, warming to his topic. "Decades, just to dig the basement. Imagine that."
Beauvoir found himself fascinated. It was indeed a feat of mammoth proportions. These men had fled the Inquisition to come here, where they were met by a climate so savage it could kill within days. They were met by bears and wolves and all sorts of strange feral beasts. By black flies so ravenous they'd strip a newborn moose. By deer flies so persistent they'd drive a saint to insanity. How horrible was the Inquisition that this was better! And instead of building some modest wooden shelter, they'd built this. It beggared belief. Who had that sort of discipline, that sort of patience? Monks, that was who. But maybe, with Frère Raymond, it was also bred into him, like Beauvoir's grandmother's patience, with blight and drought and hail and floods, with unkindness, with encroaching towns and clever new neighbours. Beauvoir looked over at Superintendent François, a son of the same soil as the monk, and as Beauvoir's grandparents. What patient plan was he working on, even now? Was it years in the making? Was he constructing it stone by stone? And what part of that plan had brought the superintendent here? Beauvoir knew he himself would have to be patient if he was to find out, though he was not exactly overflowing with that quality. Frère Raymond droned on and on. After a while, Beauvoir lost interest. Frère Raymond had the rare gift of turning a mesmerizing story into tedium. It was a sort of alchemy, another transmutation. Finally, as silence penetrated Beauvoir's now numb skull, he emerged from his reverie. Then, Beauvoir grasped at the last relevant thing he remembered. "The plan is accurate?"
"It's accurate enough so that I didn't need to draw another plan when the new system was going in. The thing with geothermal—"
"Yes, I know. Merci." Beauvoir was damned if he was going to be provoked by one man and bored to death by another. "What I want to know is it possible there's a room hidden somewhere in the abbey?" He was interrupted by a snort.
"You don't believe that old wives' tale, do you?"
asked Frère Raymond.
"It's an old monk's tale, one you've obviously heard."
"As I've heard of Atlantis and Santa Claus and unicorns, but I don't expect to find them in the abbey."
"But you do expect to find God," said Beauvoir. Far from looking insulted, Frère Raymond smiled.
"Believe me, Inspector, even you will find God here before you'll find any hidden room, or a treasure. You think we could put in a geothermal system and not have found a hidden room? You think we could have put in the solar panels, electricity, running water and plumbing, and not have found it?"
No, said Jean-Guy. "I don't think that's possible. I think it would have been found."
The meaning in his voice wasn't lost on the monk, but instead of being defensive, he simply smiled.
Listen, my son,
said Frère Raymond, speaking slowly. Beauvoir was getting very tired of being spoken to as though he was their son, a child.
That was just a story the old monks told each other to pass the time on long winter nights. It was a bit of fun, nothing more. There's no hidden room, no treasure.
Frère Raymond leaned forward, his hands together in front of him, his elbows resting on his thin knees.
What are you really looking for?
The man who killed your prior.
Well, you won't find him down here.
There was a moment as the two men looked at each other, and the cool atmosphere crackled. I wonder if we'll find the murder weapon down here, then, said Beauvoir.
A rock?
Why do you think it was a rock?
Because that's what you told us. We all understood Frère Mathieu was killed by a rock to the head.
Well, the coroner's report says the weapon was more likely a length of pipe, or something like it. Do you have any? Frère Raymond got up and led him to a door. He switched on a light, and they saw a room no larger than the monk's cells. There was shelving on the walls, and everything was neatly arranged. Boards, nails, screws, hammers, old pieces of broken wrought iron, all the miscellanies of any household, though considerably less than most. And leaning up in the corner were lengths of piping. Beauvoir moved over there, but after a moment he turned back to Frère Raymond. "Is this all you have?" Beauvoir asked.
"We try to reuse everything. That's it."
The Sûreté officer turned back to the corner. There were pipes there, all right, but none shorter than 5 feet, most considerably longer. The killer might have used one to pole vault over the wall, but not to actually brain the prior. "Where could someone find another piece of pipe?" Beauvoir asked, as they left the room and closed the door.
"I don't know. It's not the sort of thing we leave lying around."
Beauvoir nodded. He could see that. The basement was pristine. And he knew if there was a length of pipe to be found, Frère Raymond would know about it. He was the abbot down here, the master of this underworld. And while the abbey above seemed filled with incense and mystery, music and odd dancing light, down here everything felt organized and clean and constant. The temperature, the light, all unchanging. Beauvoir liked it. There was no creativity, nothing beautiful in this netherworld, but neither was there chaos.
"The abbot says he came down yesterday morning after Lourdes, but that you weren't here." "After Lourdes I work in the garden. The abbot knows that."
Frère Raymond's voice was light and friendly.
"Which garden?" "The vegetable garden. I saw you there this morning."
He turned to Superintendent Francois.
"And I saw you arrive. Very dramatic."
"You were there?" asked Beauvoir. "In the garden?" Frère Raymond nodded.
"Apparently all monks look alike."
"Did anyone see you?" Beauvoir asked.
"In the garden? Well, I didn't talk to anyone, but I wasn't exactly invisible."
"So it's possible you weren't there?"
"No, it's not possible. It's possible I wasn't seen, but I was there. What is possible is that the abbot wasn't here. There was no one at all to see him down here."
"He says he came to look at the geothermal system. Does that sound likely?"
"It does not."
"Why not?"
"The abbot knows nothing at all about this."
Frère Raymond waved to the mechanics.
"And when I try to explain, he loses interest."
"Then you think he wasn't here yesterday, after your prayers?"
"Yes."
"Where do you think he was?" The monk stood silent. "They're like rocks," thought Beauvoir, "big black rocks. Like rocks, their natural state was to be silent and still. Speaking was unnatural to them. Beauvoir knew of only one way to break a rock." "You think he was in the garden, don't you?" said Beauvoir, his voice no longer quite so friendly. Still the monk stared. "Not the vegetable garden, of course," Beauvoir continued, taking a step closer to Frère Raymond, "but his own garden. The abbot's private garden." Frère Raymond made no sound, made no movement, did not recoil as Beauvoir advanced. "You think the abbot wasn't alone in his garden?" Beauvoir's voice was rising, filling the cavern, bouncing off the walls. In his peripheral vision, he could see the superintendent and thought he heard a cough, a clearing of his throat, no doubt to stop this audacious and inappropriate agent, to correct him. To get Beauvoir to back down, back away, back off this religieux. but Beauvoir would not. Frère Raymond, for all his gentleness, all his passion for mechanical things, for all he sounded like Beauvoir's grandfather, was hiding something, in a convenient silence. "You think the prior was there as well?" Beauvoir's words were clipped, hard, like pelting the stone monk with pebbles. The words bounced off Frère Raymond, but they were having an effect. Beauvoir took another step forward. He was close enough now to see alarm in Frère Raymond's eyes. "You've all but led us to this conclusion," said Beauvoir. "Have the guts to go all the way, to say what you really think." The only way to break a stone, Beauvoir knew, was to pound it, and keep pounding. "Or do you just insinuate, hint, gossip," sneered Beauvoir, "and expect braver men to do your dirty work? You're willing to throw the abbot to the wolves, you just don't want it on your conscience. Instead you imply, suggest, you all but wink at us, but you don't have the guts to stand up and say what you really believe. Fucking hypocrite." Frère Raymond took a step back. The pebbles had turned to stones, and Beauvoir was making direct hits. "What a pathetic excuse for a man you are," Beauvoir continued. "Look at you. You pray and sprinkle holy water and light incense and pretend to believe in God. But you only stand up to run away, just like the old monks ran away. They came to Quebec to hide, and you've come down here, hiding in your basement, organizing things, cleaning, tidying, explaining, while up above the real work is happening, the messy work of finding God, the messy fucking work of finding a murderer." Beauvoir was so close to Frère Raymond, he could smell the brandy and Benedictine on his breath. "You think you know who did it? Well, tell us. Say the words." Beauvoir's voice was rising until he was shouting into Frère Raymond's face. "Say the words." Now Frère Raymond looked frightened. "You don't understand," he stammered. "I've said too much." "You haven't even begun. What do you know?" "We're supposed to be loyal to our abbots," Raymond said, sliding away from Beauvoir. He turned to look at Francois, his voice pleading. "When we join a monastery, our loyalty isn't to Rome or even to the local archbishop or bishop. It's to the abbot. It's part of our vows, our devotion." "Look at me," Beauvoir demanded. "Don't look at him. It's me you're answering to now." Frère Raymond really did look frightened, and Beauvoir wondered if this monk actually believed in God. And he wondered if Frère Raymond believed God would strike him dead for speaking. And he wondered who could be loyal to a God like that.
"I never thought it would go this far,"
Frère Raymond whispered.
"Who could have known?"
He was pleading with Beauvoir now. But for what? Understanding? Forgiveness? He'd get neither from Beauvoir. The inspector wanted only one thing, to solve the murder and get home, as Gamache said. Just get the fuck out of there, and away from Francois, who'd sat cross-legged and remotely interested throughout. "What did you think would happen?" Beauvoir pushed.
"I thought the prior would win."
Frère Raymond had finally cracked, and now the words tumbled out. "I thought after some debate the abbot would come to his senses. He'd finally see that doing another recording was the right thing to do, even without the issue of the foundations." Frère Raymond sunk to his seat and looked stunned. "We'd already done one recording, you see. How much harm could another do? And it would save the monastery. It would save Saint-Gilbert. How could that possibly be wrong?" He searched Beauvoir's eyes, as though expecting to find an answer there. There was none. In fact, Beauvoir was unexpectedly faced with a new mystery. When Frère Raymond had cracked, more than just words had come out. A whole new voice had rushed out of the monk, one without the ancient dialect. The thick accent was gone. He spoke now in the cultured French of scholars and diplomats, the lingua franca. Was he finally speaking the truth? Beauvoir wondered. Did Frère Raymond want to make sure, after all this struggle, he wasn't misunderstood? That Beauvoir would grasp each and every painful word? But far from having the impression Frère Raymond had dropped the act, Beauvoir suspected the monk had just assumed one. This was the voice his grandmother had used when she spoke to the new neighbors, and the notary, and the priests. It was not her real voice. That she kept for people she trusted. "When did you decide to defy your abbot?" Beauvoir asked. Frère Raymond hesitated. "I don't understand." "Of course you do. When did you realize he wasn't going to change his mind and agree to the recordings?" "I didn't know that." "But you were afraid that's what he'd announce, in the chapter house, that there'd be no second recording. And once the abbot pronounced, it was game over." I'm not his confidant, said Rameau. I didn't know what the abbot was going to do. But you couldn't risk it, Beauvoir pushed. You'd promised the abbot not to tell anyone else about the foundations. But you decided to break that promise, to defy the abbot.
I didn't.
Of course you did. You hated the abbot, and you love the abbey. You know it better than anyone, don't you? You know every stone, every inch, every chip, and every crack. You could save Saint-Gilbert, but you needed help. The abbot was a fool, praying for a miracle that had already happened. You'd been given the means to repair the foundation, your voices, the recordings, but the abbot wasn't listening. So you switched your loyalty to the priest, to the one man who might save Saint-Gilbert.
No,
Frère Rameau insisted. You told the prior.
No.
How many times are you going to deny it, mon frère? Beauvoir growled.
I never told the prior.
The monk was almost weeping now, and finally Beauvoir stepped back. He glanced at Superintendent Francois, who was looking grave. Then he looked back at Frère Rameau. You told the prior, hoping to save Saint-Gilbert, but instead you sent him to his death. Beauvoir's voice was matter-of-fact. And now you hide down here and pretend that isn't true. Beauvoir turned and picked up the old plans. Tell me what you believe happened in that garden, Frère Rameau. The monk's lips were moving, but no sound came out.
Tell me.
He stared at the monk, whose eyes were now closed.
Speak,
demanded Beauvoir. Then he heard a soft murmur.
Hail Mary, full of grace.
Frère Rameau was praying. But for what, Beauvoir wondered? For the prior to rise up? For the cracks to close? The monk's eyes opened, and he looked at the inspector with such gentleness Beauvoir almost had to steady himself against the wall. They were his grandmother's eyes, patient and kindly and forgiving. Beauvoir saw then that Frère Rameau was praying for him. Armand Gamache slowly closed the last dossier. He'd read it twice, pausing each time over one phrase in the coroner's report. The victim, Frère Mathieu, had not died immediately. Of course, they already knew that. They could see that he'd crawled away until there was no more away left. And there the dying man had curled into a ball. The very shape his mother had carried, had comforted, when he'd entered this world naked and crying. And yesterday Mathieu had curled up again to leave this world.
Yes.
It had been clear to Gamache and all the other investigators, and probably the abbot and the monks who'd prayed over the body, that Frère Mathieu had taken some time to die. But they didn't know how long. Until now. Chief Inspector Gamache got up, and taking the dossier with him, he left the prior's office.
Inspector Beauvoir, Superintendent Francois's voice was raised. I need to speak with you.
Beauvoir took another few steps along the basement corridor, then turned around.
What the fuck did you expect me to do? He demanded. Just let him lie? This is a murder investigation. If you don't like how messy it gets, then get out of the way.
Oh, I can cope with the mess, said Francois, his voice hard but steady. I just didn't expect you to handle it in quite that way.
Is that right? Said Beauvoir, his voice filled with contempt. No need to hide it now. And how do you expect me to handle it?
Like a man without balls. This so surprised Beauvoir, he didn't know what to say. Instead, he stared as Francois walked past him and up the stairs.
What the fuck is that supposed to mean?
Francois stopped, his back to Beauvoir. Then he turned. His face was serious as he examined the man in front of him.
You don't want to know. Tell me.
Francois smiled, shook his head, and continued up the stairs. After a moment, Beauvoir ran after him, taking the worn steps two at a time until he'd caught up. Francois opened the door just as Beauvoir arrived. They heard the sound of hard shoes on the stone floor of the Blessed Chapel, and saw Chief Inspector Gamache walking with purpose toward the corridor leading to the abbot's offices and garden. Both men, as though by mutual consent, stayed quiet until the door into the hallway had closed and the sound of steps vanished.
Tell me, Beauvoir demanded. Are you supposed to be a trained investigator with the Sûreté du Québec? You figure it out.
Supposed to be?
Beauvoir called to the retreating back. "Supposed to be?" The words echoed and grew and bounced back to Beauvoir, without apparently ever reaching Francoeur.
Chapter 23
"There you are, Chief Inspector." Frère Simon came around the desk, his hand out. Gamache took it and smiled. What a difference a chicken could make.
"Duda, Duda."
Gamache sighed to himself. Of all the literally divine music here, he had to have Camptown Races sung by a rooster stuck in his head.
"I was about to come looking for you," Simon continued. "I have your paper."
Frère Simon handed the yellowed page to the chief inspector and smiled. The smile would never, on that face, look completely at home, but it camped comfortably there for an instant. Once again, in repose, the abbot's secretary slipped back to Sevier.
"Merci," said Gamache. "You were able to make a copy, obviously. Have you started transcribing the neumes into musical notes?"
"Not yet. I was planning on working at it this afternoon. I might ask some of the other brothers for help, if that's all right with you."
"Absolument," agreed Gamache. "The sooner the better."
Once again, Frère Simon grinned. "I think your idea of time and hours is slightly different. We deal with millennia here, but I'll try to make it quicker than that."
"Believe me, mon frère, you don't want us hanging around for that long. Do you mind?"
Gamache indicated a comfortable chair, and the abbot's secretary nodded. The two men sat facing each other.
"As you worked on this," Gamache raised the paper slightly, "did you translate any of the Latin?"
Frère Simon looked uneasy. "I'm not exactly fluent, and I suspect whoever wrote it wasn't either."
"Why do you say that?"
"Because what little I could understand is ridiculous." He went to the desk and returned with a notebook. "I jotted down some thoughts as I went. Even if we managed to figure out the neumes and turn them into notes, I don't think we can possibly sing the words."
"So it's not a known hymn or chant, or even a prayer?"
Gamache glanced at the original. "Not unless there was a prophet or apostle in need of medication." Frère Simon consulted his notebook. "The first phrase there," Simon pointed to the top of the chant. "Now I may be wrong, but I translated as saying, 'I can't hear you, I have a banana in my ear.'" He said it so solemnly, Gamache had to laugh. When he tried to suppress it, it bubbled up again. He looked down at the page to cover up his amusement.
"What else does it say?"
he asked, his voice slightly squeaky from the effort of keeping the laughter in.
"This isn't funny, Chief Inspector."
"No, of course not. It's sacrilege."
But a little snort betrayed him, and when he dared look at the monk again, he surprised on Frère Simon's face a slender grin.
"Were you able to understand anything else?" asked Gamache, regaining control of himself after a mighty effort. Frère Simon sighed and leaned forward, pointing to a line further down the page.
"This you probably know. Dies Irae."
Gamache nodded. He no longer felt like laughing, and all the doodahs had gone away.
"Yes, I had noticed that. Day of Wrath. It's the one Latin phrase I recognized in this. The abbot and I talked about it."
"And what did he say?"
"He also thought the words were nonsense. He seemed as perplexed as you."
"Did he have a theory?"
"No particular one. But he found it odd, as do I, that while there is clearly in here a dies Irae, a day of wrath, there's no accompanying dies illa. Day of mourning. Yes, that struck me, too. Even more strongly than the banana."
Gamache smiled again, but only briefly.
"What do you think it means?"
"I think whoever wrote this did it as a joke," said Frère Simon. "He just tossed all sorts of Latin into it."
"But why not use more phrases or words from chants? Why is Day of Wrath the only phrase from a prayer?"
Frère Simon shrugged.
"I wish I knew. Maybe he was angry. Maybe that's what this is, a mockery. He wants to show his rage and actually declares it. Dies Irae. And then throws in all sorts of ridiculous Latin words and phrases so that it looks like a chant, looks like something we'd sing to God."
"But is actually an insult,"
said Gamache, and Frère Simon nodded. Who here might be able to help with the translation?
Frère Simon thought about that.
The only one who comes to mind is Frère Luc.
The porter?
He's not long out of the seminary, so he's closer to having studied Latin than the rest of us. And he's just pompous enough to enjoy having us know it.
You don't like him?
The question seemed to surprise Frère Simon.
Like him?
It was as though he'd never considered it before, and Gamache realized, a bit surprised himself, that Frère Simon probably hadn't. It's not a matter of like or dislike here, it's a matter of accepting. Like can turn to dislike fairly easily in a closed environment. We learn here not to even think in those terms, but to accept as God's will that the monks who are here are meant to be. If it's good enough for God, it's good enough for us.
But you just called him pompous.
And he is. And he probably calls me morose, and I am. We all have flaws we're working on. Denying them doesn't help.
Gamache again held up the page.
Is it possible Frère Luc wrote this?
I doubt it. Frère Luc doesn't like to make mistakes or to be wrong. If he wrote a hymn in Latin, it would be perfect.
And might not have a lot of humour, said Gamache.
Frère Simon smiled a little, unlike the hilarity of the rest of us. Gamache recognized the sarcasm, but thought Simon was wrong. The monks he'd met here seemed to have a good sense of humour, and to be able to laugh at themselves and their world. It was quiet and gentle, and fairly well hidden behind a solemn visage, but it was there.
Gamache studied the paper in his hand. He agreed with Simon. Frère Luc could not possibly have written this. But one of them had. More than ever, Chief Inspector Gamache was convinced this slim paper in his hand was the key to the killing. And Gamache knew he'd figure it out, if it took millennia.
The Neumes, he began, trying to work out what he wanted from Frère Simon. You say you haven't started transcribing them into notes, but can you still read them?
Oh, yes. They're confused. Frère Simon picked up his own copy.
No, that's the wrong word. They're complex. Most neumes for chance look confusing, but once you know what you're looking at, they're really quite simple.
That was the point of them. Simple directions for plain chance.
But these aren't simple, said Gamache.
Far from it.
Can you give me an idea what it sounds like?
Frère Simon looked up from the page, his face extremely stern. Severe, even. But Gamache didn't back down. The two men stared at each other for a moment, until Simon finally broke contact and looked back down at the page. After a minute or so of silence, Gamache heard a sound. It seemed quite far off, and he wondered if a plane was approaching again. It was a haunting sort of hum. Then he realized it wasn't coming from outside at all, but inside. The sound was coming from Frère Simon. What started as a drone, a hum, a note hanging in the air, turned into something else. With a swoop, the note descended and seemed to play in the lower registers before leaping back up. Not a jagged leap, but a soft soar. It seemed to sweep into Gamache's chest and surround his heart, then take it along for the ride, higher and higher. But never precipitous, never dangerous. Never did Gamache feel the music or his heart were about to come crashing down. There was a certainty, a confidence, a lilting joy. Words had replaced the hum, and now Frère Simon was singing. Gamache, of course, couldn't understand the Latin, and yet he felt he understood completely. Frère Simon's clear, calm, rich tenor held the notes, the nonsensical words, like a lover. There was no judgment there, just acceptance, in the voice and in the music. And then the final note descended to the earth, softly, gently, a tender landing. And the voice stopped. But the music stayed with Gamache, more a feeling than a memory. He wanted that feeling back, that levity. Wanted to ask Frère Simon to please keep going, to never stop. The chief realized there was no sign of Camptown Races. It had been replaced by this brief but glorious burst of song. Even Frère Simon seemed surprised by what he'd just produced. Gamache knew he'd be humming this beautiful tune for a long time to come. The doodahs had been replaced with, I can't hear you. I have a banana in my ear.
Beauvoir tossed the rock into the water as far from the shore as he could heave it. No skipping of flat stones. He chose another heavy rock, hefted it in his hand, then cocked his arm back and threw. The rock arched away and landed in the water with a plop. Beauvoir stood on the shore, strewn with water-rounded pebbles and stones and clamshells, and looked into the clear, clean lake. The waves he'd created washed ashore, breaking over the pebbles in tiny whitecaps, like a miniature world, inundated by an unexpected tidal wave, of Beauvoir's making. After his encounter with Francoeur, he needed fresh air. Frère Bernard, the wild blueberry monk, had mentioned a path. Beauvoir found it and started walking, though he didn't take in much of his surroundings. Instead, he was squirreling away in his head, going over the few words he'd had with Francoeur. And what he should have said, could have said, the clever, cutting remarks he might have made. But after a few minutes, his furious thinking and his furious pace slowed, and he realized this path hugged the coastline. The shore here was strewn with boulders and blueberry bushes. He slowed to a normal walk, then a stroll, then finally he stopped on a small stony peninsula that jutted into the remote lake. Huge birds swooped and glided overhead, never seeming to flap their wings. Beauvoir removed his shoes and socks, rolled up his pant legs, and put his big toe into the lake, then quickly brought it out again. It was so cold it scalded. He tried again until, millimeter by millimeter, both his feet were in the freezing water. They'd grown used to it. It constantly amazed him what you could get used to, especially if you went numb. He sat quietly for a minute, picking and eating tiny wild blueberries from a nearby bush, and trying not to think. And when he did think, what came to mind was Annie. He took out his blackberry. There was a message from her. He read it, smiling. It talked about her day at the law office. A funny little story about an internet mix-up. Trivial. But Beauvoir read every word twice, imagining her bafflement, the crossed communications, the happy resolution. She told him how much she missed him and loved him. Then he wrote back, describing where he was, telling her they were making progress. He hesitated before hitting send, knowing while he hadn't exactly lied, neither had he told her the complete truth of how he was feeling, his confusion, his anger. It seemed both directed at Francoeur and undirected. He was mad at Frère Raymond, mad at the monks, mad at being in the monastery instead of with Annie. Mad at the silence, broken by interminable masses. Mad at himself for letting Francoeur get under his skin. Mostly he was mad at Superintendent Francoeur. But he told Annie none of that. Instead, he ended his message with a smiley face and hit send. Wiping his feet off with his sweater, he put his socks and shoes back on. He should be heading back. But instead he picked up another stone and threw it, watching the rings disturb the calm waters.
"The funny thing is," said Frère Simon, after he'd stopped singing, "the words actually fit."
"I thought you said they were ridiculous."
"Nonsense," said Gamache.
"They are.
What I mean is, they fit the meter of the music. Like lyrics, they have to fit with the rhythm."
"And these do?"
Gamache looked back down at the yellowed page, though he didn't know what he expected. That some magic would have worked and he'd suddenly understand. But he understood nothing. Not the words, not the neumes.
"I think whoever wrote this new music," said Frère Simon, "but didn't know how to write lyrics."
"Like Lerner and Lowe," said Gamache.
"Simon and Garfunkel," said Frère Simon.
"Gilbert and Sullivan," said Gamache, smiling.
Simon actually laughed. "I heard they despised each other, wouldn't be in the same room."
"So," said Gamache, working his way through his thoughts, "the music is beautiful, we agree on that, and the words are ridiculous, we agree on that."
Frère Simon nodded.
"You're thinking there was a writing team involved, not one monk, but two."
"One wrote the music," said Simon, "and the other wrote the words." They looked down at the papers in their hands, then looked up into each other's eyes.
"But that doesn't explain why the words are so stupid," said Fresimo.
"Unless whoever wrote the neumes didn't understand the Latin. Maybe he assumed his partner wrote lyrics as beautiful as the music deserved."
"And when he found out what the words really meant," said Fresimo.
"Oui," said Gamache. "It led to murder."
"Do people really kill over something like this?" Seymour asked.
"The church castrated men to keep them sopranos," Gamache reminded the monk. "Emotions run high when it comes to sacred music. It might not be such a big step from maiming to killing."
Frère Seymour thrust out his lower lip, thinking. It made him look suddenly quite young, a boy, working on a puzzle.
"The prior," said Gamache.
"Which is he likely to have written? The words or the music?"
"The music, without a doubt. He was a world authority on neumes and Gregorian chants."
"But could he write original music using neumes?" asked the chief.
"He certainly knew his neumes, so I suppose it's possible."
"Something's bothering you," said Gamache.
"It just seems unlikely, that's all. Frère Mathieu loved Gregorian chants. He didn't just like them. It was a form of adoration for him, a great religious passion."
Gamache understood what the monk was saying. If he adored the plain chants so much, had made them his life's work, why would he suddenly diverge from them and create what the chief held in his hands?
"Unless," said Fresimo. "Unless he didn't write this," said Gamache, lifting the page slightly, "but found it in someone else's possession and confronted him. In the one place they wouldn't be seen."
Which brought the chief inspector to his next question.
"When you found the prior, was he still alive?"
Chapter 24. The door to the prior's office was closed. The last time Beauvoir had been in this position, he'd walked in on what was clearly an argument between Gamache and Francoeur. He leaned in and listened. The wood was thick and dense, a hard wood, making it hard to hear. But he could just make out the chief. The words were muffled, but he recognized the voice. Beauvoir stood back, wondering what to do. That didn't take long. If the chief was again arguing with that fuckhead Francoeur, Beauvoir wasn't going to let him fight it out alone. He rapped twice and opened the door. The sound inside abruptly stopped. Beauvoir looked around. There was no Gamache. Superintendent Francoeur sat behind the desk, alone.
"What is it?" the superintendent demanded.
It was one of the few times Beauvoir had seen Francoeur rattled. Then Beauvoir noticed the computer. The laptop had been facing in the other direction, toward the visitor's chair. Now it was turned around, facing Francoeur. He appeared to have been using it when Beauvoir interrupted him. Was he downloading something? Beauvoir couldn't see how. The satellite connection hadn't worked since they arrived. Unless Francoeur had gotten it to work. But Beauvoir doubted it. He wasn't that smart. Francoeur had the guilty look of a teenager interrupted by Mom.
"Well?"
The superintendent glared at Beauvoir.
"I heard voices," he said, and immediately regretted it.
Francoeur gave him a dismissive look, and picking up a dossier, he started to read, ignoring Beauvoir completely, as though a hole in the atmosphere had just walked in. Nothing. No one. Beauvoir was empty air as far as the superintendent was concerned.
"What did you mean earlier?"
Beauvoir shut the door hard, and Francoeur looked up. Jean-Guy hadn't meant to ask, had promised himself not to. And had Gamache been there, he certainly would never have asked. But the chief wasn't there, and Francoeur was, and the question shot out like lightning from a storm cloud. Francoeur ignored him.
"Tell me."
Beauvoir kicked the chair, then grabbed it from behind and leaned over it toward the superintendent.
"Or what?"
asked Francoeur. He was amused, not afraid at all, and Beauvoir felt his cheeks burning. His knuckles turned white where he gripped the wooden chair.
"You're going to beat me up?" the superintendent asked. "Threaten me? That's what you do, isn't it? You're Gamache's dog?"
Now Francoeur put the dossier down and leaned toward Beauvoir.
"You want to know what I meant when I said I thought you had no balls?"
"That's what I meant. It's what all your colleagues say, Jean-Guy. Is it true?"
What the fuck are you talking about? That your only use is that Armand Gamache's puppy? They call you his bitch, because while you growl and sometimes bite, they don't think you actually have balls. François looked at Beauvoir as if he was something soft and smelly real men wiped from the bottom of their shoes. The chair squeaked as the superintendent leaned back comfortably. His suit jacket opened, and Beauvoir saw his gun there. Through the howl of rage in his head, Beauvoir had enough presence of mind to wonder why the chief superintendent, a bureaucrat, wore a gun, and why he had brought it into the abbey. Not even Gamache wore a gun, though Beauvoir did, and now he was glad. That's what I meant earlier, said François. I went with you when you interviewed that monk, not because you invited me, but because I was curious. How would this man who was the laughing stock of the Sûreté handle an interrogation? But you surprised me. I was actually impressed. And Beauvoir surprised himself. Some small part of him was relieved to hear that. But it was deeply buried under the wrath, the rage, the near-apocalyptic fury of the insult. He opened his mouth, but only stuttering came out. No words formed, just empty air. You can't tell me you didn't know. François actually looked surprised. Oh, come on, man. Only an idiot could miss that. You strut through headquarters, half a pace behind your master, practically snivelling, and you think the other agents and inspectors admire you? They admire the chief inspector, and fear him a little. If he could cut your balls off, maybe he could do it to them, too. Look, no one blames you. You were this little agent in a little Sûreté outpost. You were about to be fired because no one wanted to work with you, and Gamache hired you, right? Beauvoir stared at François, dumbfounded. Right. François leaned forward. And why do you think he did that? Why do you think he surrounded himself with agents no one else wanted? He just promoted Isabelle Lacoste to inspector. Your rank. François gave Beauvoir a sharp look. I'd watch that if I were you. Not good when you're supposed to be the second in command, but she's the one left at headquarters in charge. What was I saying? Ah, oui. The chief inspector's hiring practices. Have you looked around the homicide department? He's created a division of losers. He's taken the dregs. Why? Now Beauvoir's anger finally erupted. He lifted the chair and brought it down so hard the two back legs broke off. But he didn't care. He only had eyes for the man in front of him. He had Superintendent François in his sight. Losers? Beauvoir rasped. The chief inspector surrounds himself with agents who think for themselves, who can act on their own. The rest of you shits are afraid of us. You toss us out, demote us, treat us like crap until we quit. And why? He was actually literally spitting his words across the desk. Because you're threatened by us. We won't play your corrupt little games. Chief Inspector Gamache picked up your garbage and gave us a chance. He believed in us when no one else did. And you, you fuckhead, you think I'm going to believe any of your crap? Let your weasels laugh at me. That's the biggest compliment I can think of. We have the best arrest record of the force. That's what matters. And if you and your assholes think that's laughable, then laugh. The best arrest record? François was on his feet now, his voice glacial. Like the Brûlé case? Your chief arrested him. Cost the province a fortune to try him for murder. He was even convicted, the poor shit. And what happens? It turns out he didn't kill that guy. And what did your Gamache do? Did he go and clean up his own mess? No. He sent you to find the real murderer, and you did. That's when I began to think you might not be the complete waste of space you appear to be. François gathered up some papers, but paused at the desk. You're wondering why I came here, aren't you? Beauvoir said nothing. Of course you are. Gamache is, too. He even asked. I didn't tell him the truth, but I'll tell you. I had to catch him and you away from headquarters, away from where he has some influence, so I could talk to you. I didn't need to come all this way to bring you some reports. I'm the chief superintendent, for Christ's sake. A homicide agent could have done that. But I saw the chance and I took it. I came here to save you. From him. You're insane. Think about what I said. Put it together. You're smarter than that. Think. And while you're at it, you might wonder why he promoted Isabelle Lacoste to inspector. Because she's a fine investigator. She earned it. Francois gave him that look again, as though Beauvoir was spectacularly stupid. Then he walked to the door. "What?" demanded Beauvoir. "What are you trying to say?" "I've said far too much already, Inspector Beauvoir. Still, it's out there now." He gave Beauvoir an appraising look. "You're actually a very good investigator. Use those skills. And feel free to tell Gamache exactly what I've just said. It's about time he realized someone was on to him." The door closed, and Beauvoir was alone with his anger and the laptop. Frère Simon gaped at Gamache. "You think the prior was still alive when I found him?" "I think it's possible. I think you knew he was dying, and instead of going to get help, which would almost certainly mean he'd die alone, you stayed with him for the final moments, to comfort him, give him last rites. It was an act of kindness, of compassion." "Then why wouldn't I say anything? The rest of the congregation would have been relieved to hear that even in this terrible situation, at least the prior was given last rites." He looked closely at the chief inspector. "You think I'd keep that quiet? Why?" "Now, that was the question," Gamache admitted. He crossed his legs and got comfortable, to Frère Simon's obvious discomfort. The chief was prepared for a long visit. "I haven't had all that long to think about it," the chief admitted. "I only just read in the autopsy report that the coroner believes Frère Mathieu might have lived up to half an hour after the fatal blow." "Could have doesn't mean he did." "Absolutely true. But suppose he did. He was strong enough to crawl to the wall. Maybe he fought off death to the very last second, grabbed every moment of life available. Does that sound like something the prior would do?" "I didn't think the hour and time of our death was our choice," said Frère Simon, and Gamache smiled. "If it was," the monk continued, "I suspect the prior would have chosen not to die at all." "I think Dom Clément would still be walking these familiar halls if we really had a choice," agreed Gamache. "I'm not saying force of will can fight off a clearly lethal blow, but I am saying, from personal experience, a strong will can hold off death by moments, sometimes minutes, and sometimes, in my job, those moments and minutes are crucial." "Why?" "Because it's that golden time, between this world and whatever you believe is the next, when the person knows they're dying. And if they've been murdered, what do they do?" Frère Simon said nothing. "They tell us who killed them, if at all possible." The monk's cheeks reddened, and his eyes narrowed slightly. "You think Frère Mathieu told me who killed him, and I've said nothing?" Now it was Gamache's turn to be silent. He examined the monk, taking in the full, round face, not fat, but cheeks like chipmunks, the shaved head, the short, pug nose, the near-permanent scowl of disapproval, and hazel eyes, like the bark of a tree, mottled and rough and unyielding. And yet, the voice of an archangel, not simply a member of the celestial choir, but one of the chosen, a favourite of God, gifted beyond all others, except the other men in this monastery, 2 dozen of them. Was this place, Saint-Gilbert entre les loups, a golden moment, between 2 worlds? It felt like it, out of time and place. Another world, between the vibrant life of Quebec, the bistros and brasserie, the festivals, the hard-working farmers and brilliant academics, between the mortal world and heaven, or hell, that was here, where quiet was king and calm reigned, and the only sounds were the birds in the trees and plain chant, and where, a day ago, a monk was killed. Did the prior, at the very end, his back to the wall, break his vow of silence? Jean-Guy Beauvoir propped the broken chair against the door into the prior's office. It wouldn't stop anyone, but it would slow them down just enough, and it would certainly give Beauvoir warning. Then he walked around the desk and sat in the chair Francois had just left. It was still warm from the superintendent. The thought made Beauvoir slightly queasy, but he ignored it and pulled the laptop toward him. It too was warm. Francois had been on it, but had closed it down when Beauvoir entered. After he'd rebooted the laptop, Beauvoir tried to connect to the internet. It wouldn't.
There was still no satellite hookup. So what was the superintendent doing, and why had he shut it down so quickly? Jean-Guy Beauvoir settled in to find the answer.
"Shall I tell you my thinking?" asked Gamache.
Frère Simon's face screamed, "No." Gamache, of course, ignored it.
"It's unorthodox," admitted the chief. "We generally like the people we're talking to do all the talking. But I think it might be sensible to be flexible in this case."
He looked, with some amusement, at the mule-like monk. Then his face grew solemn.
This is what I think happened. I think Frère Mathieu was still alive when you went into the garden. He was curled against the wall, and it probably took you a minute or so to see him.
As Gamache spoke, an image sprung up between the two men, a vision of Frère Simon entering the garden with his gardening gear. More bright autumn leaves had fallen since he'd last raked, and some of the flowers were in need of deadheading. The sun was out, and the day was crisp and fresh and filled with the scent of wild crabapple trees in the forest, their fruit baking in the late-season sun. Frère Simon walked down the lawn, scanning the flower beds, looking at what needed to be cut down and put to bed for the harsh winter so obviously approaching. And then he stopped. The grass at the far end of the garden had been mussed up, disturbed. It wasn't obvious. A casual visitor would have probably missed it. But the abbot's secretary was not a casual visitor. He knew every leaf, every blade of grass. He tended it as he would a child in his care. Something was wrong. He looked around. Was the abbot here? But he knew the abbot was going to the basement to look at the geothermal. Frère Simon stood very still in the late September sunlight, his eyes sharp, his senses alert.
"Am I right so far?" Gamache asked.
The chief inspector's voice had been so mesmerizing, his words so descriptive, that Frère Simon had forgotten he was still sitting inside in the offices. He could almost feel the chill autumn air on his cheeks. He looked at the chief inspector, sitting so composed across from him, and thought, not for the first time, that this was a very dangerous man.
"I'll take your silence as assent," said Gamache with a small smile, "although I realize that's often a mistake."
He continued his story, and once again the image between the men sprang up and began to move.
"You walked a few steps, trying to make out the lump at the far end of the garden, not yet concerned, but curious. Then you noticed the grass wasn't just disturbed, but there was blood."
Both men saw Frère Simon bending over, looking at the bent blades, and here and there a smear of red, as though the fallen leaves had sprung a stigmata. Then he stopped and looked ahead of him, in the direction of the trail. At the end of the path lay a figure, curled into a